Hi, everybody. This is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome to the Abbott Talks podcast. Over the past few years, the world has come to recognize Abbott as a company dedicated to helping people live happier and healthier lives. In this podcast series, we'll talk with the healthcare leaders, the executives, and the engineers who are working every day to develop new technologies to help people live their best lives. I know you'll enjoy this episode of the Abbott Talks podcast. Welcome to the Abbott Talks podcast, everybody. This is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. My guest today is Kartik Sudarisan. He is the Divisional Vice President of Global Clinical and Regulatory Affairs at Abbott Heart Failure. We'll talk about Abbott's work in this space. We'll talk about the technologies they're working on to improve outcomes and to get to patients sooner. We'll, of course, kick off with Kartik's career, which started at Georgia Tech, where he fell in love with the cardiovascular system. We'll stop off at Thoratec and ultimately end the conversation at Abbott. We'll hit upon CardioMEMS and HeartMate and a very important clinical trial that's undergoing at Abbott. It's called Team HF. You'll learn all about it here. Before we begin, I want to just let you know on one let you know about one programming note or production note. There was some background noise going on while I talked with Kartik. It was louder than I had anticipated, so it got picked up on the mic. You'll hear a leaf blower at some point, and you'll hear some engines, some sirens, rather, at another. So I apologize for the disruption. It doesn't take away from Kartik's important message and story. But I just want to let you know what you're hearing. So I know you'll enjoy this conversation with Kartik Sudarisan. But first, our managing editor, Kayleen Brown, has a message from our sponsor, Tekin.
Hal Werenberg, Vice President, Digital Transformation for Tekin. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So Hal, I want to dig right in. Can you tell us about Tekin?
Of course. Tecan is a company that's been around for a while. We've got 40 years of experience in life science business, med tech, one of our growing areas, a lot of work with clinical diagnostic areas. We work with most of the top 10 IVD players in the world. We also deal directly with laboratory automation, endpoint analysis, reagent creation for life sciences, research. And yeah, we're really excited about our mission, about accelerating healthcare innovation globally. It's something I've been doing with Tecan for almost 20 years now and super proud of.
Perfect. Thank you, Hal. We'll hear more from Tekin's Hal Werenberg a little later on in the podcast, but for now, please make sure to visit Tekin's website, www.tekin.com. That's TECAN.com. And now we're going to bring you our interview with the Divisional Vice President for Global Clinical and Regulatory Affairs at Abbott Heart Failure, Dr. Kartik Sudarisan.
Well, Kartik Sudarisan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. We always love these conversations with Abbott and eager to learn about the work you're doing in the cardiovascular disease. But as always, folks who listen to these podcasts know we like to start a bit about the person that we're talking to, a bit about their story and their history. So, Kartik, what was it that brought you to the medical device industry?
Great question, Tom. You know, when I first started my undergraduate degree, it was in computer science and engineering. So I didn't have biomedical engineering or healthcare or med tech in the radar when I started going to school. And it so happened in my final year of my undergraduate degree, I had the opportunity to work in a research lab in Georgia Tech, which focused on studying blood flow patterns in children born with heart disease. And this was just a research project for a semester. I was in the last year about to graduate and I wanted to do something different. And it kind of pivoted my career in its entirety. So that experience, first of all, was quite fulfilling and quite enriching in its experience. The professor I was working with, he was pretty well known in the space of cardiovascular disease and cardiovascular devices. And he offered me the opportunity to continue on and pursue graduate school in that area of research. So I took the opportunity. I thought the work was exciting, interesting. And that was my entry into biomedical engineering, biomedical research, cardiovascular disease. And I also had the opportunity at that point in time to work with some of the very well-known pediatric cardiac surgeons and pediatric cardiologists, both at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. And that also gave me exposure to the clinical side, you know, the patient aspect, you know, what physicians go through when they're managing patients with complex heart disease. And I just loved the area. I loved the field. I loved working with physicians. And by the time I finished my PhD, it was pretty clear to me that I wanted to go down the cardiovascular route. I wanted to go down a route where I could be working on research for heart disease. And and an opportunity came by in this company called Thoratec Corporation, who were manufacturing artificial heart pumps for treatment of advanced heart failure. And so I joined the company as a clinical scientist. This was about 15 years ago. And that's basically my entry into medtech. And then I was at Thoratec for about 7-8 years. And you know the history. Thoratec got acquired by St. Jude Medical. St. Jude Medical got acquired by Abbott. Mm-hmm. And around that point in time when the whole acquisition was happening, I had the opportunity to take a little bit of a different angle on cardiovascular devices and work in the structural heart space. So so for about 4 to 5 years, I was working on transcatheter technologies in the structural heart space within Abbott, particularly like MitraClip, TriClip, Tendyne. Those are some of the devices and technologies I was working on from a clinical studies and clinical research standpoint. And then about 3 years ago, the heart failure division was created, mm-hmm. and I had the opportunity to come back to the heart failure division and contribute, you know, in trying to build innovations for patients with heart disease. And that's kind of my whole story with respect to medical devices and medtech and Abbott.
So just looking at your education, you got your bachelor's in computer engineering at Georgia Institute of Technology, Georgia Tech. You got your master's, and then you went straight to your PhD in bioengineering, which I haven't seen a lot of PhDs in bioengineering, folks I've talked to. I've seen certainly master's, I think. But what was it that were you at Georgia Tech for the whole 7 or 8 years? Did you take some time to move off to industry? And what were the benefits of handling? I like to try to unpack some career advice for folks. What was the benefit of getting all that schooling done at once?
Yeah, so one of the things when I was an undergrad, I had the opportunity to be an undergraduate co-op with Dell Computers in the tech space. So I got a lot of exposure in terms of what are the opportunities and what kind of work I'll be doing in the technology space, right? So the way my career was progressing when I was doing my undergrad was graduate with an undergraduate degree, work for a tech firm for about, you know, 5-6 years, mm-hmm. come back to graduate school in some capacity, and then, you know, further continue my career from that point onwards. So that was where I was heading, right? And so even though I finished my degree in 4 years, in those 4 years were also 4 rotations I'd done with Dell Computers as a co-op. And so towards the end of it, I had the choice, hey, do I want to go back to industry in the tech space, or do I want to do something different? And I just felt like I was fascinated by this work, that this research work that I did in my last year of an undergraduate degree. And the only reason, I mean, one of the reasons I continued on in tech versus going to a different school for graduate school is A, because I was shifting my whole career, right? I was now moving from computer science, computer engineering to biomedical engineering and more to research, right? So so my focus was, okay, let's just make one move at a time. It kind of came last, right? I was working in my last semester. You know, I was kind of late to apply for graduate schools to other schools. So I decided, okay, here's an opportunity. Let me get some exposure to research. And it so happened that lab where I worked in was a world-renowned lab. In cardiovascular hemodynamics, and the professor is actually one of the inductees into the National Academy of Engineering, and he had he gave me the opportunity to work in his lab, you know, and work on a project that I found most passionate about, and that's why, you know, I actually joined the graduate program for PhD right after my undergrad, so I was there for about 5.5 years, and along the way I got my master's, so the master's was kind of incidental, you know, so it was
just,
not
just happened to find one.
Yeah, you do courses, you write your thesis, and you get a master's along the way, But really my focus was PhD. So yes, I was there in Atlanta, in Georgia Tech for almost 9 years. If you were to subtract like about a year of rotations I did with industry at Dell as an undergrad. But for the most part, I did it in one stretch.
And going back to your first exposure with MedTech and with the cardiovascular system, what is it about the cardiovascular system that sort of that captures your love and imagination and passion? It's a very specific thing to latch onto. What was it that you liked about it?
Yeah, so it's a great question. What I really enjoyed about it, it's the cardiovascular system operates like any other engineering system, right? You have, and it combines both fluid dynamics, which is applicable to any mechanical engineering, problem, and it also factors in electrical engineering aspects, right? There's resistance, there are capacitances, there is inertances, at the end of the day, the cardiovascular system actually is a pretty much an engineering system that you can think of the problems as an engineer. So that was the first thing that was exciting. The problems themselves are problems that are solvable in many ways by applying engineering techniques and engineering approaches to those problems. And finally, it's fascinating just from a problem standpoint and the kind of solutions that we can offer to these problems. But also what's also interesting is it's the number one cause of hospitalization in the United States, which is heart failure and cardiovascular disease. So it's a big problem that we experience in the developed world, and there is opportunity for making an impact. Like, you can make small progress in this space and have a huge impact, right? So that's what excited me the most. And to actually see the benefit of technology, the benefit of solutions to patients, and you can actually see it. Like, you can go back and see, okay, I was involved in that project that helped improve this patient's life by X years, or one of the first projects we worked on. This was probably the most impactful for me personally. Is we had we were working on a project with Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where there was a small kid with a congenital heart disease, where the existing plumbing, the vasculature, was not working for the patient, and so the surgeons wanted to redo the operation, but they wanted some advice on how to actually redo this operation in a way that's most beneficial for the patient. And so we worked on, looking at different ways that they could perform the surgery. We looked at the outcomes associated with it, and we gave several options to the surgeon. Okay, you can do it so many different ways. And he ended up choosing one procedure, and that actually helped the patient, So that was really the first real entry on how we could potentially impact, by collaborating with physicians and surgeons, who are actively saving patients' lives every day. Like, how can we improve their day-to-day day-to-day experience, and how can make things easier for them at the same time, improve the quality of life, functional capacity of patients. So that was really the most defining. We published that in JACC Cardiovascular Imaging several years ago, and I think that was the defining moment for me. Okay, this is a big problem. It's an engineering problem that I can get my arms around, right? And I think can work towards in many different aspects. I can work in this space. So that was basically my entry into the cardiovascular.
That's amazing. That's going to be very, very intoxicating to contribute to someone's to improving someone's life so directly like that. So do you, moving to the your time at Thoratec, I mean, were you looking at multiple opportunities? I'm assuming you were still in Georgia, presuming your PhD. So you're on the East Coast, Thoratec's on the West Coast. Were you planning a move west? Did you see sort of the Silicon Valley medtech startup life as yours, or where were you planning to go after you got your PhD?
Yeah, so I was looking at three different options because my PhD was focused on two elements. It was cardiovascular imaging and hemodynamic blood flow, studying blood flow patterns in patients with cardiovascular disease. So I didn't have a focus around West Coast, East Coast, et cetera, but I always knew for medtech, right? Now, Atlanta today is certainly bubbling to be a strong medtech hub, sure. But back in the day, it was not necessarily the strong medtech hub it is today, right? It was still pretty much either West Coast or Boston or Minnesota. You were looking at these three different areas. So I was pretty aware of the fact that I'll have to move to one of these three locations if I wanted to work in the medtech space. I was looking at a couple of options. I was looking at Philips or Siemens on the medical imaging side, you know, as potentially going into the research side of cardiac imaging. I was also looking at MedTech, other companies that were available. I decided to pick Thoratec for several reasons. I mean, first of all, I came across one of the researchers at Thoratec, incidentally at one of the meetings that I was part of, and we just started having conversation about clinical science, clinical research, etc. And I connected with him pretty strongly. And I also felt, because I was working so closely with physicians in my undergraduate and graduate research, I felt like in my post college career, I wanted to work in a role that works pretty closely with physicians. So it was a combination of the role, because the role itself was a clinical scientist role where I was going to work with surgeons and cardiologists in the heart failure space. And it was cardiovascular, it was medical devices. It checked many boxes. I didn't really particularly care whether it was in the West Coast or whether it was on the East Coast. I just thought the role was pretty interesting. So then, and also the individual who was hiring for this role, read one of my papers that I had written as a graduate student, and he had said, this is the kind of work I want you to do when you come into this role. So I thought that was a fantastic opportunity, and I decided to take it, and I loved every moment of it. Ever since I started working in that role, I enjoyed working with physicians, surgeons, cardiologists, engineers, and bringing the whole package together and see how we can work towards improving outcomes in patients with heart failure.
We're going to take a quick break from our interview to bring back our sponsor, Hal Werenberg, Vice President, Digital Transformation with Tecan. So Tecan very clearly has a strong reputation for partnering with leading healthcare companies. Hal, can you share with us how your OEM services are evolving to meet the needs of today's digital healthcare landscape?
Of course. When we think about like classic OEM structures, it was often we're looking at the device that we're building. So a partner would come to us and it's all about the device. What are the specifications? What's it going to do? How much is it going to cost to build? What's the cost of the development project? And these are the kinds of things. It was all about building the box, building the thing. And what we're seeing with the digital healthcare landscape changes is that it's really hitting it in multiple ways, and it's moving really fast. The first one is the devices generally have an expectation of being connected so that the company that is bringing the device to the end user has the ability to do basic monitoring, checking the functionality. Are the instruments running? Is the instrument running as much as it should be? Is the end user delighted by that instrument? Which also in turn creates a platform for the back end. So some of the mundane stuff like the automation of the billing, the automation of the logistics, whether there are consumables that need to be shipped to the end user that can be done through the monitoring platform. These are all things that also come with that. But that's just the first step. After that, we get into things like the ability to use that connection for remote service, for the remote diagnostics, so that we can make sure the instrument is running as good as it can, that the results are as high quality as possible, that the end user is getting the most out of that device at all times possible. And then taking all of that data that we have on the back end that we gather during the development phase, that we see from the real world application of it, to start using those service models, those usage models to create predictive maintenance models that are actually even potentially AI driven to understand how to make sure before the instrument actually is broken down that we can change one part in advance of those issues to reduce the total amount of service that's getting done over time to make sure that the customer is getting the most possible usage out of it, the data quality as good as it can possibly be. A lot of people will talk about this in terms of total cost of ownership. I like to think of it as providing as much value as possible over the lifetime of the instrument. But I think that's really how the OEM manufacturing of the things has really changed. It's all about the connectivity and then all the value that you can bring with that connectivity.
That's really helpful. But What about the devices themselves? I mean, are they being changed due to today's healthcare landscape?
Yeah, I think, you know, we're seeing a lot of movement in how can AI change diagnostic practices in general, whether that's personalized medicine, oncology, patient monitoring. These devices themselves are actually changing what their function is and how they do their work. And whether our devices that we're building are preparing samples to flow into the type of endpoint analysis that are feeding those insights generated by AI, or actually the analysis device themselves. So these devices are infused with the cutting edge of technology, which is really exciting because that's basically the manifestation of our mission statement, which is to scale healthcare innovation globally. And it's been really exciting to help our OEM customers who are taking these devices out into the world to do exactly that, to have an impact across the globe.
So it's always clear to me that Tecan has a value-forward strategy, which leads me to wonder, how does Tecan support its partners in navigating the complex regulatory landscape, particularly when bringing new digital health solutions to market?
I mean, first and foremost, I have to give a shout out to our quality and regulatory teams. They are absolutely phenomenal. They are one of the strengths of the organization. And I think it's exactly that strong team, which is kind of at the core of our ethos, core of our identity. And we bring that to really everything we do. But as far as what does it mean for an individual partner or customer that's working with us, we have a broad experience. So we work with most of the top 10 IVD companies that are out there. We work with huge pharma companies. We work in regulated spaces, and we do that across the world. And we have an organization that gets audited quite frequently because of these products that we make and these services that we offer. And it means that this experience we gather, we internalize in terms of best practices, we internalize it in our standard operating procedure, in our product development, but it's also something that we can gift to our customers. Because we work with so many customers, we actually have more experience in a wider range of topics and regulated environments than any single customer can. And so when you work with a partner like us, it means that you actually get that brought to you. And so even, you know, startups love it because we can kind of bring that expertise to them, whether it's a contract manufacturing thing and it's their first device coming to market and they need a lot of advice. But even large organizations navigating new spaces, the first time developing a new type of device or wondering how the European AI regulations might impact the product strategy that they're developing, these are all things that we bring an informed opinion on, and it comes from our experience and our expertise.
Well, Hal, I've had so much fun with you today. Hal Wehrenberg, Vice President, Digital Transformation of Tecan, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you.
Another huge mega thank you to Tecan for sponsoring this podcast. To learn more about how Tecan partners with leading healthcare companies, please visit tecan.com. That's www.tecan.com.
So when you moved to Thoratec, did you find that same sort of, energy and inspiration that you were getting at Georgia Tech? I'm always amazed at how the development of a medical device, particularly one as complex as what they're working on at Thoratec, but lots of other devices as well. The runway is so long that it amazes me people can spend 10 years of their life without actually achieving the thing they're set to achieve, and without certainty that they're going to achieve it with the FDA, with just the complexities of technologies. There's a bit of a leap of faith in medtech. Did you find, though, that the job at Thoratec, working in an office that sort of you were still tapping into that same inspiration that you had found at Georgia Tech?
Absolutely. I think certainly there were a lot of learnings as we, in industry, right? Like what you talked about, the long lead time for innovation, being in a highly regulated environment. So of course you have to learn how to operate in a different environment than in an academic setting where you're kind of have open discussions and open conversations with physicians, etc. I would say yes. I think I just learned to tune. I always find learning new things fascinating. So for me, even though it was a highly regulated environment, you know, things move at a different pace than what I would imagine. There was still quite a bit to learn through the process, learn about regulations, learn about quality systems, learn about how to be effective and be safe, right, at the same time. So one of the reasons why all of these systems exist, why it takes such a long time for development of medical devices, is because you want it to be absolutely safe for the patient when it ends up in, you know, in a patient, right? So I learned to appreciate all of that, you know, when I started working for Thoratec. I also always had that proximity to the physician, the proximity to the clinic, and proximity to the patient through my entire journey here in industry. So for me, that's always been the guiding principle, that it's, you have to always focus on the patient, you have to focus on the physician, and you have to focus on developing innovations that help these entities. So that always was there. I always had that proximity and visibility. So I found, I just learned how to operate under a new environment, but the energy never subsided.
Well, let's fast forward. So Thoratec would be acquired by St. Jude. St. Jude would be acquired by Abbott. And so you've remained basically, you've had three or four different employers, but have always had the same job. you're like me. What has it been like sort of moving from one corporate culture to another and then another? Any lessons learned from that experience before we get into what you're doing at Abbott? I'm just curious.
Certainly you evolve. I think there are certain, many things are the same. The focus on the patient, focus on building high quality products, focus on ensuring that you keep patient safety at its highest priority. Many of those themes remain the same. What changes from one company to another, based on at least my experience, is systems change, people change, you know, processes change, but those are all, you learn, you know, through those acquisitions. Some, you know, you operate in a different environment when you're a smaller company, and then your environment slightly shifts when you go to a bigger company, and you just learn how to operate in that environment. Mm-hmm. So for me, I was fortunate when I moved from heart failure to structural heart in 2017, that really was a defining moment for me getting integrated into Abbott, right? I think because I moved into this new role and into a new business under a new organization, Abbott, I was able to get exposure to multiple things at the same time. And so that helped me integrate into Abbott. So I learned how to actually operate effectively under an Abbott culture and an Abbott environment when I was in structural heart. So when I came back to heart failure, even though the products were similar to what they were back when I was in heart failure in my previous stint, I now understood Abbott, I understood Abbott's culture, I understood Abbott's processes, and I was able to come back and operate and, you know, with those learnings and start making an impact in that space of heart failure within an Abbott umbrella.
So let's kind of unpack the two businesses, the structural heart business and the heart failure business, since you've been in both. Just a quick overview. What, I mean, they sound like they would almost be the same business, going after the same solutions. But what is, to help folks who are listening understand the difference between the heart failure group and the structural heart group?
Yeah, a great question. So just a little bit of a history, right? So when Abbott acquired St. Jude, one of the initial steps that were taken were the creation of these businesses that were, one was structural heart. Heart failure was part of a bigger business at that time. It was called cardiac arrhythmias and heart failure, and then vascular, neuromod, etc. So these businesses were created. Structural heart was unique in the sense that it had products from both the legacy Abbott, which was MitraClip, and then legacy St. Jude, which was the TAVR products, the Amplatzer product line, the valves valve product line. So one of the interesting things about structural heart as a business in the beginning was there were two different, you know, businesses coming together for the first time under one organizational structure. From a product and the therapy standpoint, structural heart, the focus of structural heart is to treat structural heart disease. So what that means is, mm-hmm. you know, things like valvular disorders, you know, holes in the heart, or you know, anything that can be fixed by plugging holes or fixing leaky valves, right? And what was interesting about structural heart space is that it And I'm going to jump a little bit between heart failure and structural heart, right? So heart failure is a disease that's the result of a myriad of cardiovascular disease that happened before that. So you end up in heart failure either because of structural heart disease, vascular disease, you know, or some sort of rhythm disorder, right? So you end up in heart failure, but before heart failure as a diagnosis, there's a bunch of cardiovascular diseases that happen. So structural heart is one way by which patients, structural heart disease is by one way that patients enter into heart failure. So some of the structural heart solutions that that Abbott has is to treat some of those predisposing conditions that may lead to heart failure, but now if you treat them, you may actually not get heart failure. So example would be valvular disease, right? So if a patient has valvular regurgitation, like mitral regurgitation or tricuspid regurgitation, or have aortic stenosis, right, because the valve is not opening, all these are conditions of the heart that if they are not treated, you can end up with heart failure. You may already be in heart failure and have these conditions. So they, and in that case, these conditions makes the heart failure worse. So the structural heart business unit had technologies that fix valvular regurgitation in a less invasive way. That's the MitraClip. They have devices that help treat aortic stenosis, like the TAVR series of TAVR devices that can be done in a less invasive fashion. They also have devices to fix holes in the heart, that such as the Amplatzer product line. And they also have surgical valves, like mechanical heart valves and bioprosthetic valves to treat surgically treating valvular disease. So when I was in structural heart, a lot of my exposure was to mitral and tricuspid valve disease, because that was my portfolio I worked on. So so it was a very interesting time, because it was a time of rapid innovation. There were a lot of technologies that we were working on, you know, working on iterations of MitraClip. We were developing the TriClip device for tricuspid valve regurgitation. We had technology of transcatheter mitral valve replacements. We were working on a lot of innovative devices. So the four and a half years that I spent in structural heart was a time of very steep learning and very steep execution, because we were working on getting to some of these therapeutic solutions, you know, to market and to patients soon. And some of these were first in class devices, like the TriClip device, which got approved by the FDA earlier this year. That was like a first in class device for treating patients with tricuspid valve disease. So yeah, I mean, I think those 4.5 years, I think as an individual, I evolved and grew pretty rapidly and learned a lot in the process of how to get innovation from concept to market. And I think those experiences really prepared me to take on this leadership role that I have in heart failure today. So now, fast forward to heart failure. I think you asked this question. So that's how I would say structural heart is basically a little upstream of heart failure. But you may also use structural heart devices for treat some heart failure conditions when patients have both.
So that's how Abbott is approaching this world. Give us a sense of the heart failure market, and I don't like to use the term market, but the number of people who are impacted by heart failure. What is the problem that you're looking at and you're trying to solve?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, you know, heart failure is a disease that continues to grow. There are approximately 6.2 million people in the United States today who are affected by heart failure. And then if you look at it from a global standpoint, that's 64 million people globally. And that 6.2 million in the U.S. is expected to grow to 8 million by 2030. So needless to say, it's a pretty large group of patients, and that continues to grow. And it's got a lot to do with, you know, the fact, lifestyle, you know, the way things are in the developed world. So it's not going away. It's definitely not going down. It's continuing to grow. And it's the number one cause of hospital readmission in the United States, so it's a pretty serious condition. And then when you actually get hospitalized, median survival after being hospitalized for heart failure is 2.4 years from the time they get hospitalized. So it's not only is a disease that's a pretty large in number, but it's actually quite serious as well. And I think one of our key objectives is to help people with heart failure survive and thrive, and come up with solutions that allow, you know, patients to get our products to more people who need them, help people live like they don't have heart failure, and then better diagnose, treat, and manage every stage of heart failure. That's what we are trying to achieve, because we believe that this is really a problem that's pretty large in scope, and we need to take a very proactive approach in using technologies to tackle this problem.
So what are some of the programs that we went over some earlier with your answer to my question about the difference between heart failure and structural heart, but what are some of the products, the lead products you're working on now that you hope will alleviate some of the suffering and hopefully extend the lives of folks with heart failure or diagnosed with heart failure?
A great question. So one of the products we have three product lines within the heart failure division that treats every stage of advanced heart failure. So start with the CardioMEMS heart failure system. The CardioMEMS system is an implanted pulmonary artery pressure system that measures pulmonary artery pressure in NYHA class two or three patients. These are patients who are what I would call not in super advanced heart failure, but they are in heart failure. And what the sensor does, it helps to manage pulmonary artery pressure. And why is pulmonary artery pressure important? So pulmonary artery pressure is a marker of pulmonary congestion, in the sense that high pressures in the lungs. So when you have a patient with heart failure, one of the challenges is they feel out of breath, right? They feel out of breath, they feel tired. And the reason they feel tired is because they have congestion in the lungs. And I think the congestion in the lungs is happening because you're having left-sided heart failure that results in pressure backing up into the lungs. And so the CardioMEMS system helps measure those pressures and transmit those pressures to the physician. So the physician can then see these pressures remotely and see, how is this patient doing? And then can adjust medications remotely for the patient based on the pressures that the physician sees. So this is a valuable technology and has demonstrated clinical benefit in multiple randomized control trials. There have been three randomized control trials that have been conducted on the heart failure on the CardioMEMS system for patients with heart failure, and all three randomized control trials have consistently shown that using active hemodynamic monitoring using pulmonary artery pressures actually reduce hospitalization for heart failure by over 30-40%. So I think that's a huge benefit for patients, and it also relieves patients a lot because they know that they are now in control of their heart failure symptoms. It's no longer this big unknown that they have to deal with. So on the CardioMEMS system, we have been, one of the aspects that we continue to work on is help patients, get more in control of their heart failure symptoms, making some of the data available to them. So we have a program right now that's in development where we're trying to see how we can let patients see their pressures and patients and physicians interact more actively with patients through apps and other digital solutions. So that's on the CardioMEMS side.
How frequently, just sticking with CardioMEMS for a moment, how frequently do your pressures change? Do they change by the minute, by the day? I mean, if I were looking at my pressure right now, how frequently will it go up and down?
So they tend to fluctuate over the course of the day, depending on various factors, depending on what food you ate, so it is variable. But what typically physicians look at is patients take their measurements once a day, perhaps a few times a week. They generally look at trends, right? They factor in some of these variabilities that can potentially happen. And they generally, and they have a target range that they're shooting for each patient. And they'll see, is this patient within the target range or not? So usually a patient who is well managed, who's stable, the pressures would not change, fluctuate as much, right? But but you have situations, it's Thanksgiving time, right? So, you may have turkey, you may have other food that could potentially result in an increased pressure, right? And the doctor will be able to see that, and then could be able to manage some of those symptoms remotely, right? So that's the benefit of having a remote patient monitoring of pulmonary artery pressure. And I just want to distinguish pulmonary artery pressure from blood pressure, right? Blood pressure is systemic. Sure. Blood pressure, PA pressure, is more a specific marker for heart failure. And that's why the implanted sensor actually helps. It actually helps to provide more accurate information about the patient's condition that the physician can actively manage.
So you're not tracking, it's not a glucose monitor where you're tracking hourly to make adjustments. No. You're really just checking to see if a patient's getting sicker or not over a longer period of time.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, great. Sorry to interrupt. What was the other product you wanted to move into before I...
The other big one is left ventricular assist devices, the Heartbeat 3 product line. We are the market leader and the only provider of this, of a left ventricular assist device. And the an LVAD, that it's called, right? An LVAD actually helps treat patients in advanced heart failure. So they are in YHA functional class 4, which is the sickest of patients with heart failure, whose heart is now working at less than 20% capacity, right? It's working less than 20% capacity, and so the HeartMate 3, for example, is implanted in these patients who are extremely sick, and it takes over the function of the left ventricle. And so what the HeartMate 3 does is it pulls blood from the left ventricle and pumps to the ascending aorta, and thereby replacing the function of the left ventricle. And so the HeartMate 3 is a unique device because artificial heart pumps have been under development for, I don't know, 40, 50 years. But it's only now with the HeartMate 3 that we see the kind of outcomes that are improving survival beyond 5 years. The median survival for patients who receive a HeartMate 3 is more than 5 years now. Until, you know, previously it would be, you know, 2 years, 3 years. And the beauty of the device is it prolongs survival, but has also has low adverse event burden compared to some of the other previous generation devices, particularly as it relates to device clotting or device or strokes and bleeding. So that makes HeartMate 3 a unique device, in the sense safe for patients, and it also prolongs life. Of course, there are lifestyle changes that the patients will have to undergo as a result of an LVAD implant. But overall, you know, we see significant improvement in outcomes associated with HeartMate 3 as it relates to quality of life improvement, functional capacity improvement, and as well as absolute survival, prolongation of life.
So is there an opportunity, and you're right, we've had HeartMate featured at Device Docs Boston more than once, and certainly been written about in our magazines, and it's a remarkable device, and I actually have a neighbor who's, unfortunately, her brother is currently needs one as well. It is a lot of, it requires you to carry the device, obviously requires a serious procedure to implant the device, but is there an opportunity there for, I know you're working in the next iteration, but is there an opportunity there to make it available to more patients? It seems like if you're, and I don't know what the benchmark is or the milestone is, but if you're waiting for a patient till their heart is that sick and then you're intervening at that point, it almost seems as if they might benefit if you intervened a little bit earlier, so it wasn't as much of you could get them while they were still healthy, or maybe help them live a better life if you get to them a bit earlier. I guess my long-winded question is, are there moves to move HeartMate or another product to help patients earlier on in the heart failure process?
Absolutely. And that's a big focus of us in the heart failure division of Abbott. I'm just going to start with some numbers and then kind of walk you through, you know, what we are actually doing to address that very question you asked, Tom. So, you know, right now, HeartMate 3 is used in predominantly the sickest patients, as you alluded to. And these patients who get the HeartMate 3 device today have almost a 60 to 70% chance that they will not be alive at 1 year, right? So this is really the end stage. So you can imagine the heart is in pretty bad shape. The patients, generally the organs are not in great shape. Now the HeartMate 3 helps reverse a lot of that by providing additional blood flow, but sometimes the patients are just too far along. And I think if you look at the overall survival improvement you get with HeartMate 3 with over, you know, close to 60% at 5 years, there's a huge opportunity for us to address patients a little earlier than when they actually get the devices today, right? So for us to get into the into a patient population such that they are not in the sickest stage when they get the device, There are a couple of things that we need to work towards, right? I think the first part of it is just education of the community about the benefits of LVAD. So that's definitely something that we are doing pretty actively, working with our just to kind of educate everybody about what an LVAD is and what a HeartMate 3 is, and the fact that the outcomes have significantly improved over the course of the year. The other piece also we are working on, this is a new clinical trial that we just launched a few weeks ago called the Team HF clinical trial. This trial is unique in many different ways. It's an investigational device exemption trial, so it's an IDE regulated trial. And what we are attempting to accomplish through this trial is three things. So we already have the CardioMEMS device available for heart failure patients, as we just spoke about. Right now CardioMEMS helps with monitoring patients with advanced heart failure as well. The other advantage that CardioMEMS can offer is it can also identify a patient when they are actually going down the hill in terms of worsening outcomes. So in other words, if a patient's pulmonary artery pressure continues to be high despite everything that the patient's physician has done, and the patient's refractory to guideline-directed medical therapy at that point, that patient could be considered to be a good candidate for advanced heart failure therapy such as HeartMate 3. So the trial, and what it also does is it provides an objective criterion, objective measure for physicians to look for to identify when a patient should actually be considered or referred for an advanced heart failure therapy. So we took that idea, and we have lots of preliminary data that we had both on CardioMEMS and other studies that we have looked at, which seem to indicate that pulmonary artery pressure is actually a strong predictor of an adverse clinical outcome in patients.
Okay.
So we took those data points and we designed the Team HF trial with three objectives. The first objective was we want to prove the hypothesis that patients with high PA pressures that don't go down with guideline-directed medical therapy, that they should be referred for advanced heart failure therapies. That's objective number one. And objective number two is these patients, when they actually receive the HeartMate 3 LVAD, actually have significantly better outcomes than not receiving an LVAD. And the third objective is to actually utilize the power of the CardioMEMS system to help further improve outcomes once they have an LVAD. So we have three different objectives kind of folded into this trial. And what we hope to achieve is be able to demonstrate that, look, there are all these patients who are not getting these therapies and they're dying before they actually show up in an advanced heart failure clinic. With this evidence, we want to prove and help physicians identify these patients early and then provide a roadmap on how they can actually treat patients with the HeartMate 3 and help improve overall outcomes. We also believe that getting the device to these patients a bit sooner, and that's one of the hypothesized benefits of this trial, is that the patient's heart will respond better. The patients will respond better to the procedure. They will recover faster. They'll have better quality of life. Some of the end organ function damages that happen when you wait too long, some of those may not happen if you pull the trigger a little early. There'll also be an opportunity for the native heart to get better and recover as well if you get to get with an LVAD early. So there are a lot of benefits of that we believe that this trial will show. And the uniqueness of this trial is, for the first time, you'll be combining two technologies that are kind of complementary to each other in a way that can help improve the overall clinical outcomes in patients with advanced heart failure. So we're pretty excited about it. We just launched the study.
No, that's amazing. So currently, I think the only way to get off of the HeartMate or an LVAD is to receive a donated heart, correct? Your heart doesn't regaining strength. Could we get to a point where you are just bridging the heart and getting it back to it to a healthy point where you wouldn't need a transplant?
Yeah, I mean, there are. So one of the indications for HeartMate 3 is the use of HeartMate 3 for myocardial recovery. So it happens.
Okay.
It happens in a small percentage of patients, partly because most of the patients who receive the HeartMate 3 today are so sick that the heart is so far down the line that it doesn't recover. But there is evidence and there are studies that have shown that in some patients, if you were to use the HeartMate 3, basically you rest the heart You know, you give the heart some rest to recover, right?
A cast for a broken leg or something like that.
Yeah. Exactly. So you give it some time to rest. The HeartMate 3 does the job, of pumping blood to the rest of the body. And then in some cases, the heart actually recovers, and you can either explant the device, where you remove the device in its entirety and the patients live with their native heart. There are many, many patients who have had their devices explanted as a result of myocardial recovery. Or even if your heart function actually improves, right? Even if you keep the VAD in there, the patients just feel a lot better. They experience better outcomes, right? So there is definitely a possibility of recovery. So, either you can explant the device, you can leave the device in, or the patient just continues to, live their usual life and see better clinical outcomes.
Wow, that's amazing. So, what are the challenges what were the challenges for recruiting for a trial? Where are you in the recruitment trial, and how difficult is it to find patients for this trial? Because you're looking for a different, a less sick group of patients than you had tested on previously. Is that accurate?
Yeah,
patients
that's accurate.
Were less ill than before. Yeah, than your previous patients.
Absolutely. I think, so we have just launched the study. We had our first site activated just a few weeks ago. And we do expect enrollment to be challenging in the beginning. And just because it's a different way of looking at patients. It's a different way of assessing patients. And so we believe initially there may be some challenges, but we do think at the end of the day, once centers and investigators get into a certain rhythm and workflow in being able to use the trial protocol to identify patients and are able to have conversations with patients and then start experiencing positive outcomes as a result of participating in the study, that we will see enrollment catch up and enrollment pick up. But we are, like with all clinical trials that aim to shift the paradigm of clinical management, right? This is a trial that will change the paradigm of clinical management in advanced heart failure. It has the potential to change the guidelines. It has the potential of changing how patients, of physicians manage heart failure. So we do think there will be a lot of learnings for programs and how they develop their own workflows for the trial, and once they develop the workflows for the trial, it then will expand into their daily clinical practice once the trial results are out and once we get FDA approval for the new indications.
Do you have a sense of a timeline that you'd like to see happen? I know things are unpredictable with trials and regulatory approvals and whatnot, but what does this the next few years look like for Abbott, and anything else that you're looking forward to in the future that you want to sort of hit upon quickly?
Yeah, I think we certainly want to push for driving enrollment into the study over the next 2 to 3 years. We just recently completed the ARES trial. I don't know if you heard about the ARES trial, but the ARES trial was just before TeamHF. That gave us the confidence to start designing TeamHF. The ARES trial was a novel clinical trial that looked at the use of whether or not aspirin should be used in patients with a HeartMate 3 device. And it was the first ever randomized double-blinded placebo-controlled trial that was conducted in the LVAD space. And that what that trial showed, and we presented those findings and published it in Journal of American Medical Association last year, was that just removing aspirin from the postoperative management of patients with the HeartMate 3, you can reduce the bleeding rates and bleeding complications by almost 39%, reduce the hospitalization for bleeding events by close to 35%, and you end up substantially improving the clinical outcomes just by making small incremental changes, to the medication regimen. So we got FDA approval for the updated labeling in earlier this year. We got global approvals as well. And so over the next 2 to 3 years, we want to really focus on disseminating the new findings, educating people on the study while we are continuing to launch and drive ARES, drive the TeamHF of clinical trial enrollment. I just want to say, in general, the way we are looking at clinical trials is we really it's not just about getting running clinical trials to get a device approved. Yes, that's sometimes an objective of clinical trials, but clinical trials also can significantly help improve patient outcomes, can help provide access to therapies for patients who need them, and so we are almost looking at clinical trials as in the same vein as product development right now, which is how do we use clinical trials to further drive, improve clinical outcomes, advance clinical science, and expanding access to our therapy. So pretty excited about some of the clinical trials that we have just finished and the clinical trial that we are starting with respect to Team HF. Enrollment-wise, you know, the couple of 2 to 3 years, we'll see how the study happens. Hard to predict, like you said, exactly how long it'll take to drive enrollment, but this is going to be a big focus for us over the next couple of years.
Well, Kartik, you clearly haven't lost the passion that you discovered at Georgia Tech, so I really enjoyed hearing your story. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me, and it was great speaking with you as well.
All right, well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much to Tekin for sponsoring this episode of the Abbott Talks podcast. Thanks, of course, to Abbott for making Kartik Sudarisan available for this important conversation. Thanks, of course, to our very important listeners. Yes, that's you. We really appreciate your support of the Device Talks podcast network. I hope you'll subscribe or follow the Device Talks podcast network on your podcast application so you don't miss a future episode. And of course, share this episode on social media so others can enjoy the conversation. I also hope you'll connect with us on social media. You can find me, Tom Salemi. You can find our managing editor, Kayleen Brown, on LinkedIn. Please connect and follow with Device Talks. And of course, Abbott as well. Be great to be part of your future med tech conversations. All right, once again, it was great to bring you this episode of the Abbott Talks podcast. We'll get working on the next one right away. Take care, everybody.